We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. I think it's safe to say that very few students in the United States were ever taught about the earliest Jews who came to the American colonies. So today, we are going to do a deep dive into early Jewish history of North America and the role that Jews played in the American Revolution. And my expert guest today is Professor Tobias Brinkmann. Welcome, Tobias.
Hi.
Professor Brinkmann is the Malvin and Leah Bank Professor of Jewish Studies and History at Penn State University. His book, Between Borders, The Great Jewish Migration from Eastern Europe, was published by Oxford University Press in 2024. And his book, Sundays at Sinai, A Jewish Congregation in Chicago, was a finalist for the National Jewish Book Award in 2012. So, Tobias, you chose the famous passage to read from the Declaration of Independence. Why did you choose that passage, and what is its significance for Jewish history in North America?
This passage matters greatly for the actually relatively few Jews who lived in colonial America at this time. So there were about 2,000, maybe 3,000, not more. The crucial sentence is that all men are created equal. So there are two issues involved that are really important here. One is simply the fact equality, legal equality, and also citizenship. These were not enjoyed by Jews in Europe. That's where most Jews were living. Most Jews were living in, you know, generally Eastern Europe, that probably 90% of the world Jewish population. And they had no rights at all. So they were not allowed to own land. They were not allowed to work in many occupations. And the economic situation was pretty awful. But it's important to keep in mind that that also applied to many Christians, actually most Christians. So this is not a specific Jewish affliction. However, Jews faced really official discrimination because they were not Christian. There was pressure really for Jews to convert to Christianity. There was a certain, you know, specifically ugly aspect about the way Jews were treated in Europe. In colonial America, that actually was quite different. Jews were de facto equal. They were allowed to own businesses, they were allowed to own land, even slaves in a few cases. But of course, they didn't have citizenship. Nobody had citizenship, of course, right? Except a few British officials. And so, not surprisingly, many Jews were very invested in the case of the American Revolution. The formal acquisition of citizenship, that's a really important achievement for Jews. So I always point this out. Jews didn't really matter very much for America. They didn't matter very much for George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. But the other way around, the American Revolution mattered greatly, much more than for the few Jews who are already here, who, as I said, already enjoyed de facto equality. It mattered greatly for Jews in Europe, because here actually was a place where Jews acquired full citizenship and were formally equal with everybody else. That mattered greatly.
Really, really interesting. Okay, so you mentioned a lot of stuff that we're going to discuss slowly as we go through the episode today. Also, how Jews played a part in the American Revolution. But let's maybe just start with the beginning here. Why don't you talk about the first Jews who settled in North America?
Yeah, this story begins a good 100 years earlier in 1654. That's a very important date in modern Jewish history. The story is actually it's a really wonderful story. In 1654, most of North America was not really colonized. So there were a few coastal settlements along the eastern seaboard and on the west coast, very little had really happened at this point. And one of the most famous ones, of course, is New Amsterdam. That's at this point the very southern tip of what is now Manhattan. And in 1654, according to this story, and I'll explain a little bit why there's quite a bit of substance to that. We have quite a bit of documents about the story. 23 Jews, supposedly 23, actually we don't know the exact number, but about maybe 20 Jews arrived on a decrepit ship from the Caribbean and asked to stay in New Amsterdam, which at this point is a Dutch colony. It's actually not an official Dutch colony. It's run by a private company, the West India Company. And the governor of this company, his name is Peter Stuyvesant, was not excited about having to accommodate these Jewish settlers for two reasons. One was they were poor. They had nothing. That's a problem. The other issue was they were Jews. So we know from the letters he wrote that he didn't like Jews because A, they couldn't be trusted in business matters. They were supposedly treacherous and greedy. So that's the economic stereotype about Jews. And second, they were responsible for the killing of Jesus, the crucifixion. So this is the other much more dangerous Christian stereotype. But he didn't expel them, which I find very interesting. This is on an, you know, this is far away and on a colonial outpost. Nothing, nobody would have ever said anything if he just would have dumped them, you know, across the Wall Street, and they probably would have not have lived very long. But he followed the process. So he wrote a letter to the board of the West India Company in Amsterdam. And that took 6 months to get there. And then it takes 6 months for the other letter to get back. And the board basically tells him they're very sympathetic. They don't really, you know, like this idea of poor people and they don't like Jews. But actually, Jews were on the board of the West India Company as investors. Jews in Amsterdam, because Amsterdam had actually accommodated Jewish businessmen who came from Portugal as refugees. And they were very successful as traders, and they were on the board. They were investors in the West India Company. And that's why the West India Company somewhat reluctantly decided that Governor Stuyvesant could not expel the Jews from New Amsterdam. So he writes another letter back. So this goes on. But basically, in 1655, this letter that he gets, the first letter he gets from Amsterdam, that is sort of seen as the basis for Jewish life in North America. The irony of the story is really that there was already a Jew in New Amsterdam before these settlers, these refugees came. And I should say they came from Recife in what's now Brazil. Recife had also been a Dutch settlement. It was taken over by the Portuguese. And the Portuguese, instead of brutally slaughtering people and expelling people, they were actually very nice. There was no fight. They even allowed Jews to stay in Recife, except for Jews who had reconverted from Christianity to Judaism. So this is a complicated story. Many Jews were persecuted and many sort of converted to Christianity, but then reconverted once they were able to do that. And those Jews were not allowed. But everybody had 6 months' time to leave, and the Portuguese even gave provisions. So calling them refugees is a little tricky. Most Jews in Recife went to Amsterdam, but a small group decided to stay in the Western Hemisphere for economic reasons. And they wind up in New Amsterdam. That's the story. There's already a Jew there. And Stuyvesant never had any issues with this man. This is somebody who was not poor. He was a businessman. He came from Lithuania. His name was Asa Levy. And apparently he may have come with two other Jews. We're not sure about that. But we know about him. And he, in 1664, that's 10 years later, when the British show up in New Amsterdam and take it over, again, not a violent affair at all, it's very peaceful, and Dutch settlers were all allowed to stay, it was not a problem. Asa Levy is still there. He would die in what's now New York. The 20 Jews, or maybe 18, maybe 23, they had all left by 1664. So again, this is why this story is a little tricky. It's just a typical story of people who are moving around. But the point that matters here is that Jews were allowed to stay, and they had essentially the same rights as Christians, although officially that wasn't the case, but these rights were not, or these restrictions were not enforced in these outlying colonies. And they could also trade relatively freely in Portuguese and even Spanish settlements because it was all about business.
what the story makes me think about is, for example, Africans in Florida under Spain, who had many more freedoms or were much more free than, say, enslaved Africans in the colonies, indigenous peoples in Florida under the Spanish king had many more rights and freedoms. And it's interesting, of course, in Florida history, these groups of free black people, when Britain takes over, go to Havana, and the Spanish government actually supports them because they're subjects. And they say, okay, yeah, you know, we're going to support you. We're going to subsidize your travel to Havana. And thinking about the story of the Jews in Recife, depending on the sort of monarch and the structure of the colony they were living in, there were a vast difference in the quality of their lives and the description or the legal status of who they were as people. And I just think that's an interesting link with the free blacks in Florida and the indigenous in Florida. So fascinating story.
Very true.
Yeah. Now that I mention it, you mentioned Jewish people in Recife. What about, slight detour here maybe, what about, were there any Jews in the Caribbean and in the Florida colonies under the Spanish crown?
Yeah, so the oldest Jewish community in the Americas that has existed since the colonial period is actually in Curaçao. And the name is already a giveaway. Curaçao to this very day is a Dutch colony, but it was initially, the name is Portuguese, so there's a back and forth, but the Dutch eventually controlled it. That is the oldest extant Jewish community. There's a really old Jewish cemetery there. And who was the governor of Curaçao in 1654? Peter Stuyvesant. So it's the same. And he never had any issues with Jews in Curaçao. So it's sort of interesting. At least we don't have letters about this. Basically, under the Spanish crown, or the Portuguese crown, in fact, Catholic rulers did not tolerate Jews as settlers. So as visitors, traders, that's okay. But as settlers, that's really not happening. So we do not really have Jewish communities in areas that were really controlled by the crown, the Spanish crown, that is. But we have crypto-Jews. So this is a very complicated story. And there's quite a bit written about this in recent years, so we know more about this. There were even crypto-Jews in places like New Mexico, and of course in Peru and so forth. There were certainly people who really converted out of conviction to Christianity. So we do have those certainly living in colonial America, so under Spanish rule. But what is so interesting is that there were niches opening up in Dutch and English colonies in this period, where Jews could live openly as Jews, practice Judaism, and be de facto equal. That is already remarkable. And the American Revolution basically puts a seal of approval on that and actually gives these Jews formal citizenship, along with the other settlers who, of course, up to this point were also had not always citizenship officially.
Okay, and so you're starting to move towards the American Revolution, but let's maybe slow down a bit. Did you want to talk about the case of, say, New York?
I think the interesting place is New England. So New England is a fascinating story, right? We have the Puritans who arrive earlier, so in the early 1600s. I used to teach at the University of Southampton, so that's a big deal there because the Puritans didn't actually start out in Plymouth, but they bought the ship in Southampton. So these were very rigid.
I'm sorry, you mean Southampton in the United Kingdom?
In the United Kingdom, not in Long Island. Yeah. And these were rigid Protestants who were essentially expelled from England. They found asylum in the Dutch provinces, and they decided to go to America in the early 1600s to essentially build their utopian community. And they essentially reenact the Exodus. So this is quite fascinating. They, in a sense, see themselves as the Jews moving back to Israel, right? This is what this is. And Boston is Jerusalem, right? So they set out, and as everybody knows, they reach Plymouth and then, of course, built this Massachusetts Bay Colony. What is really fascinating is when real Jews showed up there. So around the same time, 1650s, 1660s, it was really interesting for a day or so, but then they wanted these Jews to convert, and so it was very obvious that they did not tolerate Jews in their midst. So we see this a little bit in Stuyvesant, But with the Puritans, it was much more rigid. And there's a fascinating story. I mean, we know a lot about the Puritans, the Salem trials, and they were also very rigid with dissenters. So the most interesting figure is Roger Williams, who is a theologian who disagrees with the other Puritans, and he's expelled and banned from the Massachusetts Bay Colony. So he has capital. He goes and funds a new colony, which is still around. It still has that name, Rhode Island and Providence Plantations. That is actually the official name of the state. Rhode Island is only the short form. And he explicitly embraces Jews and what he called Turks or Muslims in his new colony. He also is opposed to slavery, and he also embraces indigenous people. So this is a really interesting man who, in my opinion, deserves much more attention. And this is also the reason why the oldest Jewish community emerges in Newport, Rhode Island, long before many, many, many decades, centuries even, before other communities emerged in other parts of New England. And the legacy of the Puritans also explains why Jewish life in Boston really only begins in the 1850s, when a growing number of Catholics come in, providing a sufficient cover for Jews to establish Jewish life there. So this is quite an interesting history. New England is quite different. And I think this is also important for colonial history, that these regions are all very different. We also have Jewish communities in Savannah, in Charleston, of course, in Philadelphia. And they have different histories. They're connected to different trade networks. Slavery is an issue. In fact, the Jews in Newport were involved in, some Jews in Newport, Rhode Island, were actually involved in the slave trade after Roger Williams had passed away. And this is a, you know, transatlantic venture, of course. And here's another irony of the story. The West India Company was almost bankrupt in 1654. And what kept them going was the slave trade. And a few Jews were involved in that, unfortunately.
I want to talk about the Jewish involvement in the slave trade, but you mentioned a lot there, and I just have some kind of follow-up comments. So you mentioned this gentleman, Roger Williams, who goes to Rhode Island and the Providence Plantations. Now, as I've been thinking more and more about colonial history, what I see is decisions made about being accepting of other religious beliefs and within Christianity or without, and some lack of tolerance. But oftentimes there's what I think and I'm being cynical now, an ulterior motive always for changing a religious policy, and it's usually economic. You know, in the episode about homosexuality, it was not wise to execute a white, wealthy farmer who is in control of a big estate because he happens to be a homosexual, because that would be very bad for the economy. So, you know, you're going to let things slide. So going back to this gentleman, Roger Williams, to what extent is he being tolerant because it's smart economically? And to what extent is it that he has some deep ideals about freedom of religion?
With Roger Williams, it is genuine. This is a theologian. And yes, the colonization is a brutal business. I mean, many indigenous people were already dead at this point in the early 1600s. It's all about making money, no question. But there were people who had a vision for this place, and Roger Williams is certainly one of them. And this is really a remarkable figure. And it's also interesting, the first biography of Roger Williams was written by a Jewish man, Oscar Straus, who actually became the first Jew who was a cabinet secretary in Theodore Roosevelt's administration, 1905, I believe. So Jews did recognize how important this figure was. There's a couple other figures who I think had ulterior motives and who looked beyond the money-making, people like William Penn. So it's not all about money, so to speak. But yes, I think it's important for long-time historians have ignored, especially the fate of the indigenous people and also the slaves, right, who are very much part of this economy. For Jews, it was just really important that they could fit in. I should also mention, this is not a time when somebody in Eastern Europe can just say, oh, why? I just go to America and have a better life there. This was really complicated at this point. So transportation was complicated. even getting to a port in Europe, people couldn't move freely. There were a lot of restrictions. Most people, most Christians were literally tied to the land. So moving to America at this point is still very difficult for most people in Europe. And of course, the slaves didn't get there voluntarily in the first place.
I want to press this point a little bit further. If we start thinking of the colonies as individual competitive marketplaces for expertise, labor, networks of trade, then it would make sense to be more welcoming to as many people as possible. It's a competitive advantage. Come to Rhode Island instead of the Carolinas or whatever, yeah?
Exactly. So this is, of course, the case in other parts of the world for Jews. If you think about the history of the ghetto in Venice, for instance, that is the same situation. There is this is an independent city state, but it's still Catholic, and Catholics are less tolerant than some Protestants. Jews are not really a threat for, as far as Protestants see it, because they're not going out and converting people to Judaism. Catholics are absolutely not okay with non-believers, as they see it, living in their midst. And so the history of ghettos in Italy is really quite interesting. They exist for this very reason, because it was about business. Jews were attractive because they had, these were not the Jews. These were certain Jews who had trading connections. This is trade that goes all the way to China, the Silk Road, the rise of the Ottoman Empire makes it complicated. And so this is the sea route then through the Indian Ocean. And Jews were involved in that, and that made them attractive. And that's why this ghetto is created in Venice. It's a compromise. On the one hand, Jews are not really allowed in, but on the other hand, they are needed for the benefit of the city's economy. And that's why we even have a ghetto in Rome, which was controlled by the Pope. It is the nastiest of the ghettos, but it existed for economic reasons, of course. So that's why in the New World, it was even freer than in these, you know, tightly regulated spaces in the Mediterranean. And the Dutch provinces, I should mention, are also quite interesting in this regard. The Protestants were rigid, so Catholics were not tolerated. Certain Protestants were not tolerated, but Jews were allowed to settle in Amsterdam. And that's a positive story, and it's actually documented in the portraits that Rembrandt painted. He lived in very close to the area where most Jews lived. They were not forced to live anywhere in Amsterdam. There was no ghetto. But many lived in the same area and right around the door, right close to Rembrandt. And so this is a very positive story, and it opens really a chapter to a new future where Jews can be equal and can be citizens. And again, this becomes really concrete with the American Revolution.
Okay, good. So we're talking about the Jews' search for equality, but we're going to get back to Judaism and slavery. So why don't we just take that path right now?
Slavery is a complicated issue. So it is just the economic system, and some Jews participated in it, in the slave trade. So that's actually worse than owning slaves, right? And some Jews own slaves. I mentioned Asa Levi, probably the first Jewish settler in North America, who lived initially in New Amsterdam and then New York. So we have a document, his will, and it does say he owns this, and he owns a house, and he owns a, quote, in big quotation marks, a Negro boy. So that is pretty common. It only shows that Jews were de facto equal, right? There were no restrictions. Were there Jews who had objections? Just like Christians, of course. And this becomes more interesting in the 19th century when there's a growing abolitionist movement. And it's quite interesting. There are a number of Jews, especially from culturally German, so this is after the Enlightenment, who are really strongly opposed to slavery. And these were mostly rabbis and play an important role in the period leading up to the Civil War, calling for abolition. But there were also Jewish rabbis who basically argued, no, slavery was legitimate because, you know, if you look in the Torah, slavery existed at the time of ancient Israel, so there was nothing wrong with it. So I mention that simply because it's really important not to essentialize Jews as a group, right? They're just like everybody else. There's different arguments, and they're basically basing these arguments on the same documents as the Christians, which is, you know, the Ten Commandments in different passages in the Torah or in the Old Testament. So Jews are involved in it, but not across the board. And this is simply a very loaded story because during the civil rights struggle in the 50s and 60s, anti-Semitism plays a role. And of course, this came up that supposedly all Jews were in the slave trade. And as a result, we have a lot of scholarship on this issue. And it turns out that, yes, a few Jews were involved in the slave trade, but many Jews weren't. And many Jews didn't own slaves. So it's a very mixed picture. And it's important to look at the facts and to fight these stereotypes.
Were there Jews who were plantation owners who would need like dozens and dozens and dozens of field hand slaves? Or was
not as far as I know, no. So generally the niches that Jews filled in places like Charleston and Savannah were in the trade. And there were also Christian traders, so this is not...
So these would mostly be like servants in at home rather than the... Not that it's less brutal, but the brutality of the, say, the cotton plantations.
Correct.
Are right. Okay.
But of course, they do business with the plantation owners. And,
of course.
You know, so it's, yeah, nobody... Yeah,
it's not good.
No, yeah, it's just the way it
works. Degrees of problem.
Yeah.
You mentioned rabbis and synagogues, and maybe we can take a little bit of time now. Can you discuss sort of the first synagogues and the first sort of... religious ideas or religious concepts in Judaism that were common in the first synagogues in North America?
Yeah, so this is actually quite simple. America was really far away from Europe. It took 2 months to cross the Atlantic on sailing vessels. Many sailing vessels never arrived. It's risky at this point. The first ordained rabbi only immigrated to what then was the United States already in 1840. So we only have lay members in these colonies, and they belong to what Jonathan Sana, who's the really leading scholar in this field, described as synagogue communities. So pretty much every Jew in New York, in Philadelphia, Savannah, Charleston, belongs to the one synagogue that's existing there. They're all lay members. They don't know the tradition very well. Some are not very observant, but they are tied to that community. And there's actually very little intermarriage. So they did stick together. These are families. And again, intermarriage is also tricky, not only because of religious issues. This could also be an issue for the Christians, because usually you had to convert to Christianity if you married a Christian. It's also about business, right? These are families. This is all about inheritance. And this is not a time when people married for love. So many marriages were arranged. And so that also explains why it's very tight-knit. And it's basically a good story. I mean, we know quite a bit about colonial Charleston and Savannah, and Jews didn't face a lot of discrimination. They were accepted as business partners. But there are also clear lines. In a sense, there was not a lot of socializing after hours, I would think. So the lines were clearly drawn. And remember, this is a time when the Protestants are also splitting into different denominations. And Jews fit right into that picture. And did some Jews have very close Christian friends? Absolutely.
But going back to the synagogues, so I understand now 1840 is the first time an actual rabbi comes in. But there were synagogues before 1840, yeah. Correct?
So some of these synagogues, initially, they're actually informal. So this is where the regulations come in. I had mentioned that, of course, officially, Jews were not equal at all. They were tolerated to live in the Dutch provinces and also under English rule. But there were still these special laws on the books. So Jews didn't have citizenship. And again, many others didn't have that either. So initially, we have these informal synagogues. So Jews would just meet in a room. That's still the case in America today, right? A lot of small Protestant groups just meet in some room somewhere. So this is not unusual. And Jews adapt to the American system very quickly. They synagogues do not have the meaning they have in Europe at all. So you get a building, it's a synagogue, you sell it to some Christian congregation, you buy a Catholic church and turn it into a synagogue. So that's pretty common already in the 19th century. So in the 17th and 18th century, especially in the 17th century, it's initially informal. But then some of these communities became, you know, pretty well-to-do. There was money, and there was the idea, well, the Christians have their churches, or the Protestants, really. We should have a synagogue. And the interesting case is New York. That becomes the largest community in the early 18th century. And Jews were not allowed to build a synagogue on the books, but they are building a synagogue very close to Wall Street in 1723. And I find this really interesting because there were way more Catholics in New York. There was even briefly a Catholic governor, a British governor who happened to be Catholic. But it was out of the question. A Catholic church would never be built under British rule. So the first Catholic church in New York is only built after the Revolution in the 1780s. So that's, I think, telling. And again, Jews were a small group. Nobody really considered them as a problem or let alone a threat. So they get away with building their synagogue in New York. And there's also a synagogue, if I'm not completely wrong, built in Philadelphia before the Revolution. So this becoming sort of formalized, these communities become really rooted, and many members are wealthy enough to fund such a building. So that's also showing how, you know, lenient the regulations weren't really strictly enforced. And by the way, that's the same in the Caribbean. So if you look at places like Curacao, Jamaica, it's also an old community under British rule. Jews have synagogues, can freely practice Judaism. It's a non-issue, really.
I'm just remembering the religion episode that maybe our listeners remember, too. Each colony did have its own rules about how to allow, typically, if they were going to allow other Christian denominations to exist formally. There were rules about taxation, of course. The Baptists were seen as being problematic in many colonies because they were openly proselytizing and they technically needed permission to do so, and they refused to follow the rules. So it just seems like in this very diverse religious environment, some colonies took a more strict perspective on other religious points of view, Christian or not. And that's what I find interesting about this Jewish story. It seems like a more tolerant religious colony was tolerant of a variety of Catholicism, different religious dominations, and by extension, Judaism or Islam as well, presumably.
Correct. The colonies all differ, and there were limits. I think that's important. So Jews couldn't serve in offices because for that, Christian oaths were required. And of course, that was a no-go. And it's interesting, some colonies became states, and New Hampshire and North Carolina are quite interesting. They only abolished these oaths in the middle of the 19th century. So this actually, you know, was not taken off the books after the Revolution. So it shows again how influential these states were. And it's noteworthy that this was abolished before the Civil War, right? The Civil War, the upshot of the Civil War is that the federal government, of course, became much more powerful. It was a war over slavery, but states' rights were an issue in it. And this does also explain why these oaths had finally came off the books, but before the Civil War.
But whereas in a colony and then state like Virginia, we have then a much more robust protection of religious freedom.
Correct.
Okay, good. So let's now, we've covered a lot of history, and let's now get to the Jewish participation in the American Revolution. Why don't you tell us that story, please?
Yeah, I wanted to mention one point just very quickly. These Jews are often described in many history books as Sephardi Jews. I think this is important. So Sephardi is the term for Spanish. So Jews who came originally from the Iberian Peninsula. Here, another date is important, 1492, the date when Columbus discovered or rediscovered America. That is also the date when the Spanish crown formally expelled all Jews from Spain, from the empire. And that includes southern Italy, for instance. This was violent. Muslims were also expelled. This is the year Granada fell, so the last town, or last city controlled by Muslims. And this is brutal. The Inquisition had already been in place for a long time. And this is also the reason why Jews didn't want to live under Spanish rule, because of the Inquisition, which also was active in the New World. And they were looking for Jews, and especially for Christians who were secretly practicing Judaism. So the standard narrative in many textbooks is that most Jews moved to the colonies before the American Revolution were Sephardi Jews. So Jews who came from Spain or Portugal with names like Rodriguez and so on. In reality, most Jews who moved to the colonies actually came from Eastern Europe. They were Ashkenazi Jews. They just adapted the Sephardi prayer rite. So the Sephardi Jews were the ones who set the rules, who were in charge, who were the establishment. And we are talking about a few hundred people here, right? So it's important. But most Jews were actually Ashkenazi. So this is something I just wanted to mention, the result of research in the last, 20 years or so. So now we know that most Sephardi Jews were actually Ashkenazi Jews from Eastern Europe. So I wanted just to mention that.
That's really interesting. And now I'm going to force you to move on.
Yeah.
To the American Revolution.
Yeah, the American Revolution, in a way, in American Jewish history, it's almost a non-event. There were about 2,000 to 3,000 Jews. I could mention some names here, but it's not really important. They were actively involved in it as soldiers, even in a few cases in higher rank. But they're really not very visible. And the reason is simple. There just weren't very many. What is interesting is that most Jews joined the revolution. So there were really only a handful of loyalists. That plays out differently with other Christian groups, like the Mennonites, for instance. So the important point is that Jews actively participated in the revolution. And they also actively suffered the consequences, which was destruction, losing their businesses. Often this involvement came at a very high cost. Some, of course, died, were killed. So that is pretty much all that is to say. What is interesting is that Jews are not mentioned in any of the founding documents. They are strikingly absent. There is just no mention of it. The Declaration of Independence doesn't talk about Jews. The American Constitution doesn't talk about Jews. And that is noteworthy because in Europe, a few decades later, beginning with the French Revolution, the Jewish question is a big issue. They're mentioned all the time. And there are not very many Jews living in Europe either. A little more, but we are talking about less than 1% in the colonies, less than 0.1% perhaps. And that is important. So there's no debate about Jews and rights, nothing. It's non-issue. The Jews participate in the revolution. Some are familiar, are actually personally acquainted with some of the leading figures. But, I think for them, these were more just actual people and the religion didn't really matter. And actually, religion didn't really matter for the founding fathers. This is also important. It did matter, but in a sense, most of the founding fathers were pretty secular, we would say today. They were not particularly observant. They were very much influenced by the Enlightenment. If you look at a figure like Thomas Jefferson, for instance. So that would also explain that. The point that matters is that all white men became citizens. And thus, all white men, this included Jews, became citizens with the revolution. And that is remarkable. And this is a unique case because in Europe, in every state, there was a formal decision and often a debate to what was called emancipate Jews. This is interesting because the term emancipation refers, of course, to slaves who are given freedom. That's where the term comes from. And it's actually only in the 1820s that the term is used for giving Jews citizenship. In the United States, that is a non-issue. And that also explains why anti-Semitism develops differently here. There are these older stereotypes about Jews and money and Jews and Jesus. But the really racist anti-Semitism, it doesn't really catch on until around 1900, so much later than in Europe. It's a very different story. And Jews in the United States, and to a certain extent also in Canada, in other states in the Americas, they were not the one visible minority. They were in places like Germany or France. There were other groups who fared much, much worse. And so the setting was just entirely different. And that's, again, why the American Revolution really matters.
So the important criteria of being a Jew in this context was that they're not black, I'm talking about, in the New America. But maybe, again, if I can ask another question, do you think that Jews weren't singled out for good or ill in any of the founding documents. Do you think that's because there just weren't a lot of them, or because there is some sort, well, idea that, well, they're white?
Both, I think. I mean, it was simply a non-issue. I mean, in a sense, there wasn't a very large Jewish population. Jews didn't go out and try to convert people. They were decent, hardworking people, in a sense, you know. And so it was a non-issue, basically. And again, there weren't very many to begin with. And we could talk about Washington's letter to the Jews of Newport very briefly, because here we do have actually one document where George Washington does talk to Jews, and he makes a pretty interesting comment.
Okay, and let me just read that, and then you can do your commentary. So this is George Washington's letter to the Jews of Newport from 1790. The citizens of the United States of America have a right to applaud themselves for having given to mankind examples of an enlarged and liberal policy, a policy worthy of imitation. All possess alike liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship. It is now no more that toleration is spoken of as if it was by the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoyed the exercise of their inherent natural rights. For happily the government of the United States, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens in giving it on all occasions their effectual support. Okay, so what's the significance of that letter?
This is a remarkable document. The upshot here, it's pretty simple. George Washington, of course, like presidents today, traveled around the country and visited communities. And again, this is also about elections and voters. And it was known that he was going to visit Newport in Rhode Island. We already mentioned it's an old community in this state. And here we have this letter that he writes after the visit. And for a long time, scholars just read the letter uncritically. It turns out that much of the letter is simply repeating what the Jews wrote to George Washington before the visit. So there's another letter that the Jews wrote to George Washington, and a lot of it just repeats it. But there's this one paragraph in there that you just read that's not in the original letter. And the key sentence in here is the sentence that is a little complicated. It says, "It is now no more that toleration is spoken of as if it was by the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoyed the exercise of their inherent natural rights." So this is really interesting. Toleration and tolerance are two very different things. Toleration is a policy, so an official policy by a state. Tolerance is, you know, just a practice, essentially, a social practice. Jews were formally tolerated in many places, including in the colonies, in fact. In the new United States of America, that's gone. There is no more policy of toleration. So in other words, there are no minorities officially, right? Everybody is a citizen. Well, of course, already we know there's a problem here, which is the slaves. This doesn't fit. This is sort of the construction error involved in these founding documents that doesn't really work at all if you take the Enlightenment very seriously. And this is actually the beginning of the movement for abolition, right? Because it actually violates these principles. But at this point, slavery is sort of seen as a completely acceptable practice, certainly in the southern states. But this is a remarkable sentence in a way, where Washington directly addresses the Jews of Newport and makes it clear, you know, you have full citizenship here, you have American citizens, you have rights, you have obligations, and the government of the United States is protecting you. You have the right to vote. So that's really a remarkable document that we have that really confirms very much what I said earlier. Jews don't really matter that much. There are not very many, but here we do actually have this one case where George Washington is actually addressing them, and he makes very clear what matters about the American Revolution.
Yeah, and this other line, all that is required is that you demean yourself as good citizens, as just be a good citizen, which is what is expected of everyone and anyone.
Yeah.
And that's all that matters. All of these other issues that might have caused bigotry and persecution in the past are now irrelevant. If you are a good citizen, you are a good citizen, full stop. Really, really interesting. Okay, so let's move on with our story. Let's maybe talk a little bit about the post-Revolutionary War period. How do we want to start thinking about the Jewish community in the early years of the new republic?
Yeah, this is fascinating. Again, when I teach this, nothing really changed. You know, that's you know, there's a dramatic event apart from the losses that many people suffered because of the fighting, which was intense, especially in the places where Jews happened to live. Nothing really changed. This is, again, showing that Jews were de facto equal before the revolution. But what changed is what I said earlier, namely, Jews in Europe noticed this. They noticed that here was a new republic, and it gave full citizenship to Jews. So that's really an important change. And right after the American Revolution, we have the French Revolution. And in the French Revolution, the upshot is similar. Jews get full citizenship rights, but only after a debate in the Assemblée Nationale that went on for months and months and months. And some pretty ugly things were said about Jews in this debate. And the understanding was that Jews should really give up everything, even their religion, really. That was the expectation, to be full French citizens. And this becomes a little ugly when the revolution becomes more radical. Of course, synagogues were closed, but so were Christian churches. But essentially, French Jews retained their full citizenship rights. There's a little back and forth under Napoleon, but by and large, France is a success story. But it is very different from the American case, where it was a non-issue. There's no discussion about Jews. There's no Jewish issue, nothing. So the obvious question is, why don't Jews leave Europe in large numbers right away? As I said, this is already still very complicated. And I always like to mention the Irish and many German-speaking migrants who came to the United States after the Napoleonic Wars. It was terrible. They crossed the ocean on sailing vessels. It was really rough. The worst was the seasickness, the thirst, because there was no fresh water, which is particularly cruel because you're surrounded by water and you're really thirsty. This goes on for 6 to 8 weeks, pretty challenging. The Irish, the situation was even worse. The ships were cheaper and many ships just vanished. Many people suffered disease. It was just pretty awful. So it is really only the rise of steamships in the late 1840s, which became common by 1870, that made the crossing bearable. So it is still pretty complicated. The other issue is the railroad. So before the railroad expansion in Central Europe, that's really the case by the 1850s in a place like Central Europe, so what's now Germany and Belgium, people went by boat on these large rivers. Like they took a boat in like Mainz or Worms, and then they went all the way up to Rotterdam, and then from there. So this took longer. People walked long distances. So you already see this is complicated. It becomes easier with transportation, with the transportation revolution, so railroads and steamships. But for Jews who moved to the United States, that is a really remarkable issue here. They were not full citizens in Central Europe, so Germany fully emancipated, gave citizenship to all Jews when it was founded as a nation state in 1871. There were a few states like Baden. Baden is the first state in Central Europe that gives full citizenship rights to Jews, 1862. So for many of these Jews who leave, and that is even more the case for Jews from Eastern Europe, the Russian Empire never emancipated Jews. They literally liberate themselves by crossing the Atlantic, by stepping on America's shores, where they very quickly can file for citizenship papers and naturalize. So that's important. But again, was that the real reason why they left? Not really. It was economic. The economic conditions were really promising in the United States after just before the Civil War and also after the Civil War. And it's actually a remarkable success story. But these Jews benefited greatly from the founding documents, from the fact that they could just become citizens, that anti-Semitic stereotypes were widespread, so these traditional anti-Jewish stereotypes, but anti-Semitism not so much, and they became very accepted. There were Jews who were elected mayors of some cities out in the West. It was certainly easier in the West than on the East Coast. And so this success story was only possible because of the American Revolution, actually.
Yeah, it sounds like that phrase that you read, "it's complicated for many groups, all men are created equal," did actually mean something for the global Jewish community. Okay, that was a fascinating discussion. I think we're reaching the end, and I ask all my guests the same thing. 250 years after the Declaration of Independence, as a historian, what do you think of the document 250 years now after it was written?
Yeah, it's remarkable. I mean, again, from the perspective of American Jewish history is a remarkable success story. And that was only possible because of the American Revolution. You know, in a sense, there were hardly any Jews in colonial America, and there were only few Jews involved in the revolution because there were so few. But the many immigrants who came here, mostly from Europe, found freedom and were able to live as Jews in a way they could have never done in Europe. And yes, anti-Semitism is a constant issue in this story, but compared to Europe, it is never as dangerous. So American Jewish history really is an unrivaled, remarkable success story. And the most fascinating area, I should really say, is ironic. In the Declaration of Independence and the American Constitution, religion and state are clearly separated, right? This is important. It creates real challenges for Jews because these traditional communities as they exist in Europe that are state regulated, often to this very day, like in Germany, that's not the case here. The state is not involved in that. That's a challenge. So constant grassroots support is important. But the diversity and vibrancy of Jewish life in the United States is almost without parallel, I would say, compared to many other places. So it's really a remarkable story. And also the fact that it's often sort of a non-issue. There are many other groups. Jews don't stand out that much. American Jewish history is a really success story. And it's made possible by the achievements and the documents that we have that rule and regulate life in the United States to this very day.
All right. Professor Tobias Brinkman, thank you very much.
Great.
Life, liberty.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americazentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americazentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americazentrum.de. Thanks for listening.